This is a podcast from Bloomsbury TNT Clark. Find us online at www.bloomsbury.com or on Twitter at TNT Clark.
I'm here with James Aitken of Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge, who has edited a marvellous companion on the Septuagint for us, which will be out in the spring. James, I wonder if you could start us off by telling us what the Septuagint is.
The Septuagint is actually quite difficult to define. In simple terms, it is the Greek translation or the Greek version of the Old Testament. It combines, therefore, translations into Greek of both the Hebrew and Aramaic Bible, but in addition to that, extra books, which are often referred to as the apocryphal or deuterocanonical books. The Septuagint, therefore, represents the first translation of the Bible and the first collection of the Bible in Greek, beginning in the 3rd century BCE when the Pentateuch was translated, but also representing translations and books going on much later up to the 1st century CE.
And the version that we have of the Septuagint, the versions that we have of the Septuagint, where did they come from? Where did those manuscripts come from?
Ultimately, there's a long history of transmission of the manuscripts. But the first time we can begin to talk about a Septuagint is in the major codices of the early church, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and so on, from the 4th century onwards. But even there, the Septuagint is part of a Greek Bible which includes the New Testament. So the Septuagint by itself doesn't really exist until much more modern times. It was always seen as part of the Christian Bible. Having said that, though, it started out as a Jewish text. It started out before Christianity as individual translations. And therefore, when we talk about the Septuagint, we're talking about a volume, a large volume, received in the Christian church, but made up of multiple texts from ancient Judaism.
Mm-hmm. And this companion that you've been working on for us for many years now, and we're very excited to be publishing it soon, is structured in a very particular way. I wonder if you could explain how you've structured it and why you've decided to structure it in that way.
Yes, the structure of the companion is arranged by biblical book, rather in the fashion of an old-fashioned introduction to the Old Testament or introduction to the New Testament. So unlike other introductions to the Septuagint, which explain the history of the problems and the history of the text, this explains each biblical book and the translational version that we have of it in the Septuagint. Therefore, you can look up Genesis and find everything that we know, or at least a summary of what we know, about the Septuagint version of Genesis. And then when we look at each book, we've divided it into a number of sections, obviously beginning with the editions where people can locate a copy or the best edition of, let's say, Genesis. But then a discussion of the date and context, as far as we know, which we have to derive from the evidence of the text, the language of the book, the text's critical significance of the Septuagint, because it's one of our earliest witnesses to the old biblical text. And then also we have possible evidence of the ideology of the translator, his indication of his own Jewish theology or his context. And finally, we have a brief section looking at the reception history, how that particular book in its Septuagint version has been received in both Judaism and Christianity.
Mm-hmm. And I know when we've had conversations in the past, you've often said that one of your great hopes with this volume is that it will open up what can at times be the relatively small world of Septuagint studies to other disciplines within biblical studies. How do you think it will do that? And could you sort of expand on your hopes for the volume in that sense?
My hopes are that many people will use the volume because it's aimed at providing a summary and a resource that people interested in most areas of biblical studies or ancient Judaism should want to use. The field of Septuagint studies is complex and in many ways technical. And so the idea of this volume was to bring the technical material together. So for many of the chapters, original research had had to be done to cover and summarise the various perspectives for the biblical books, so that there is quite a lot of new material and new gathering together of data that's not available anywhere else currently. And the idea would be, supposing you're a biblical scholar working on the book of Judges, here you can have for the first time a neat summary of all the issues around the book of Judges, of the textual history and how the Septuagint fits into that. And most importantly, from a biblical scholar's perspective, the tendencies and the ideas of the translator are indicated. And therefore, rather than making rather rapid judgments about how the Septuagint has translated the Hebrew text, the biblical scholar can now have a greater appreciation of how the translation works as a whole, and therefore will make more of an informed judgment about how we should use it for biblical text criticism.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, other scholars will use it. New Testament scholars will obviously be interested in it for the way the Septuagint is used in the New Testament, but also for the linguistic information, the way the Greek of each Septuagint book is differentiated and highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
And also, one of my great wishes in Septuagint studies and biblical studies is the use of the Septuagint in Jewish studies. So far, there are many books on Hellenistic Judaism that almost never mention the Septuagint, which is the first product mm-hmm. of Greek-speaking Judaism. And so, through the sections on the history, the language, and the date of the different Septuagint books, one hopes that scholars of ancient Judaism will use the Septuagint as a historical resource and not merely see it as a resource for the text of the Bible.
I suppose that draws us nicely on to speaking specifically about one of the books, one of the biblical books within the Companion, and how the Septuagint sheds light more broadly. And I wonder if you could give us some specific examples of that.
A good example of a Septuagint book that sheds light on broader issues beyond just the biblical text is actually a translation such as the translation of Psalms. Psalms obviously has a long history and the textual complexity is immense, but it also has a very important place in Jewish and Christian tradition. In the case of the Septuagint translation, it follows the Hebrew text very closely. So some people would call this a very literal translation, that each Hebrew word is rendered very carefully by each Greek word. But if we look more closely at Psalms, we see a great subtlety in the choice of language. And one thing that the chapter on Psalms explains is that the language develops using liturgical language in the Greek world of the time, which is perhaps no surprise.
Mm-hmm.
But it particularly uses the language of Egyptian cults, such as the cult to Isis and Serapis. So that what we see there is actually a subtle way of representing their identity in Egypt as Jews worshipping God. They identify themselves as a small cult. They did not use the language of the Olympian deities. They did not use the language that you would use of Zeus or Hermes, but they used language that was local for small cults. And this might be a little clue to how prayer life in Egypt was understood amongst Jews, that they saw themselves as participating in a prayer situation in their prayer houses that we know existed in Egypt, in the same way that fellow Egyptians saw themselves as participating in prayer life in the cult of Isis and so on. So that through subtle indications like that, we get an opening up into the world of Judaism and of Jewish worship.
Mm-hmm. So we really sort of through the Septuagint get a unique window on diaspora communities particularly.
Yes, exactly. It's always been a debate in Septuagint studies as to how far you could say there's interpretation in the Septuagint. Have they really changed their text and reinterpreted it for their own community? And there's always some doubt as to whether there's been a change or whether it's just a textual variant. But I think close attention to language, as the example of the Psalms I've given, helps us to actually see that there is naturally a re-expression of their identity and a re-expression of their place in the wider world through the translation. And that's why the translation gives us wonderful access to more than the biblical text, but to the text as understood in the Hellenistic and Roman world.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether the Septuagint can be particularly fruitful when we're looking at a text that's maybe very late, a text where we don't entirely know what the original language it was written in was, something like Tobit, for instance, where the textual and linguistic issues are extremely complex, and the versions that we have seem to be very different from each other. Would you say that the Septuagint, in a way, would be the best way into a text like that, and the Septuagint version would be the sort of most authoritative?
Tobit is a very interesting example of a Septuagint text. We have fragments of Greek, of Hebrew and Aramaic from Qumran, but we do not know which is the original, the Hebrew or the Aramaic. And in fact, the fragments are so small, we have to begin with the Greek version. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the Greek version is terribly important. But in Tobit, there are at least three Greek versions. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to decide which is the original Greek version. Mm. Is it a longer one or a shorter one or a combination of the two? And therefore, what Tobit shows us is that we're perhaps mistaken sometimes about talking about a text. Mm. In the case of Tobit, there are three Greek texts. And we could apply the same model to other Septuagint books, that we have the Hebrew version of a biblical book, and then we have the Greek version. And they do differ slightly. Mm. In most books, some, such as Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they differ greatly. And having those differences means we really have more than one text.
Mm.
And if we're talking as historians, when we're discussing what is Jeremiah, what does Jeremiah believe, we have to take into account that there's more than one version. So the Septuagint naturally opens up to a plurality
mm-hmm.
of the ancient world.
Mm. And I suppose with something like Tobit, the Latin is actually very important as well.
Yes, yes. As soon as we go into the so-called apocryphal books, mm. we start opening ourselves up to a number of newer questions where the Latin, which can be very important, particularly the old Latin, can be very important even with other biblical books, but with the apocryphal books becomes very important as a witness to a very early Greek text, which was then translated into Latin.
Mm. Yes, I suppose the apocryphal books are a big can of worms.
Yeah. Yes. Well, there's also the problem as to which ones one includes in the handbook on the Septuagint, because different canonical traditions have a different number of apocryphal books. My definition was to take Ralph's, which is the standard one-volume edition of the Septuagint, and use that as the limit. But there could be a case for not including 3 and 4 Maccabees, which I did include,
mm-hmm.
or adding additional works to it as well.
Thank you for all of that. I think we're starting to run out of time. So I wonder if you could finish up by talking a little bit about your next project. Sadly, I don't think it's one for T&T Clark, but I'm sure people will be interested to hear what you're working on next and how maybe how this volume has given you new angles to research.
Yes, my current project is to look again at the origins of the Septuagint. We know the first books translated were the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And now, through having the companion, I can access the history of scholarship and the key issues with each of those five books. And I want to look again at the origins of the Septuagint because we know so little about it. It was sometime in the 3rd century BCE in Egypt, but beyond that we know very little. The legends about the origins give a certain narrative, but those narratives seem to have been written later with the intention of bolstering the community in Egypt and the identity of the Jews of Egypt. So I want to go back and look carefully at the text of the Septuagint and compare it to what we know of the use of Greek in Egypt at the time, and draw comparisons with how Egyptians used Greek, how even Egyptian identity was built up through the use of Greek, and how scribes actually wrote Greek as a way of explaining the translation technique in the Septuagint. So The plan, therefore, is to create a new understanding of the origins of the Septuagint as a document of ancient Egypt, and therefore re-describe the origins as the origins of a Jewish group in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that there must be a lot in the Pentateuch that chimes with the sensibilities of a Jewish group in Egypt.
Yes, they often refer to terms from Egypt. They use Egyptian loanwords occasionally. They talk about the doctors as embalmers. In the end of Genesis, the doctors are the embalmers, which is very much an Egyptian practice. Mm-hmm. And Joseph, when he's appointed as governor of Egypt, he is appointed as a toparch, toparchis in Greek, which is the term for local governors in Egypt. So the text is almost realised and imagined as a text of Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And how is that handled with respect to sort of wanting to get out of Egypt? Because that's sort of almost a conflict of interest in a sense.
And this is the funny thing, how much all of Jewish Greek writings are set in Egypt, including texts such as the Wisdom of Solomon in the Septuagint, which is a condemnation of the Egyptians and a treatise on their destruction in the Red Sea in Egypt, but it's written in Egypt. Mm-hmm. So it does seem to be a strange conflict of identity and of almost dissonance between their position in Egypt and the scriptures which talk about Egypt. I think one of the issues to bear in mind, though, is that at this time, Egypt was not Egyptian, Egypt was Greek. Mm. And in many ways, the Jews see themselves as Greeks. Mm. And their whole educational identity is as Greeks. And Egyptians are the people living in Egypt, but the culture is Greek, as well as Greco-Egyptian. So that you can be in Egypt as a Greek and still condemn the Egyptians, but stay in Egypt.
Mm. And Egypt is a sort of ideological place as well as a geographical place or a geographical entity.
Yes, you can be... Egypt is a symbol of your mm-hmm. deliverance, mm-hmm. even if you don't actually leave Egypt.
Well, on that note, I think it's probably sensible to finish. Thank you very much, and hopefully the sales of the Companion will go extremely well, and your next project will as well too.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more details on the Companion to the Septuagint, please visit our website at www.bloomsbury.com.